this year. So
oh, okay.
It's a little bit.
There's a lineup usually, right?
Yeah. Yes. Of people wanting to.
Is there? Or are you?
No, there are. Okay. There are.
I haven't
people,
been in a few years. So.
Yep. There are people there that are wanting to get first crack at the boxes. And I was over at KBXE yesterday. No, on Monday. I don't know what day of the week it is, but someday. Monday. And I was looking through the boxes and I'm like, ooh, it's just the album art, especially out of the 60s and 70s. Some of it was a little crazy.
Yeah. Very cool to see. Coming up, let's see, at 7:45 this morning, we get a chance to check in with Larissa Donovan, a reporter out of Northwestern Minnesota. She'll tell us about some of the stories you can expect at our website at kaxe.org.
And if you're looking for opportunities to see live music, there's a lot going on this evening. Grant Edwards will be at Smoke in the Water in Coleraine tonight, starting at 6. And Steve Grillo will be at the Ore House in Gilbert, starting at 6. Seth Dowd is at the Turtle River Chop House in Bemidji, also starting at 6 o'clock. And Dave Simonette and Dave Carroll will be at the Cedar Lounge in Superior, Wisconsin. That starts at not 6, but 6:30.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at kaxe.org.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Former State Senator Justin Eichhorn is being released to a halfway house in Duluth, a federal judge ruled on Wednesday. Chelsea Perkins has more.
The Star Tribune reports from the in-person hearing in St. Paul that Judge Shannon Elkins says the government failed to meet its burden. Federal prosecutors had requested to keep Eichhorn jailed for the federal charge he faces for soliciting someone under 18 for prostitution. Elkins also says she did not believe Eichhorn was a flight risk and cited his lack of criminal record and ties to the community. Prosecutors had asked for Eichhorn to remain jailed in a motion filed Sunday. They alleged that he attempted to obstruct the investigation by lying about having a gun in his St. Paul apartment and by asking a, quote, close associate to retrieve a laptop from the residence. During testimony on Wednesday, Eichhorn's attorney Charles Hawkins identified the associate as Eichhorn's wife, Brittany. His attorneys say the jailhouse conversation was cherry-picked by prosecutors and instead showed a discussion about their business and her need to get the laptop for those purposes. Brittany Eichhorn has since filed for divorce in Itasca County District Court. In the halfway house, Justin Eichhorn will be subject to GPS monitoring. Eichhorn was one of 8 men arrested in a law enforcement sting operation in Bloomington after he responded to an online ad for paid sex. He arranged to meet who he allegedly believed was a 17-year-old girl, but was instead an undercover officer. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
Republican Senator Robert Farnsworth of Hibbing was elected chair of the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board in a special meeting Wednesday. Eichhorn was named the IRRRB chair last month. The winner of the special election to fill his seat will serve on the board. Filings opened Wednesday for the Senate District 6 special election. 5 Republicans have officially entered the race as of Wednesday evening. Steve Cotariu of Merrifield, Doug Kern of Brainerd, Dr. John Howe of Grand Rapids, and Kerry Heintzman and Jennifer Carnahan of Nisswa. Candidates have until April 1st to file. Early voting for the special primary will begin April 9th. Primary election day is April 15th. A school bus load of children were dropped off unexpectedly Tuesday in rural Crow Wing Township. The Star Tribune reports 2 fourth graders jumped in to save the day after their bus driver suffered a medical emergency on their ride home from school. Lucy Marshall spoke to the 74-year-old bus driver about missing a stop, but he didn't respond. Brainerd Superintendent Peter Grant told the Star Tribune that the driver didn't know where he was. The bus stopped on 100th Street, some 4 miles south of downtown Brainerd. Marshall and Cabe Story ushered their fellow students off the bus and had them stand on the side of the road. The Brainerd Dispatch reports the Crow Wing County Sheriff's Office and Brainerd Police responded to the report of children asking for assistance just after 3 p.m. The children were found about 10 minutes later. The dispatch reports the driver was found another 2 miles from where the kids were dropped off and transported to Essentia Health St. Joseph's Medical Center. According to the sheriff's office, he was last listed in serious condition. Sanford Health Bemidji's frontline workers were recognized and celebrated at the annual Sanford Health Improvement Symposium last week. Larissa Donovan was there and has more.
Sanford Bemidji is the largest employer in the Bemidji area, and the symposium featured research projects done across the hospital system to improve safety and patient experience while also making hospital operations more efficient. In cardiology's heart failure program, registered nurses Anna and Melinda focused on readmissions and found solutions through patient and staff education. Heart failure is the leading cause of hospital readmissions there.
We had noticed that our numbers were increasing over the past couple of years. So we started focusing on that because when patients are readmitted, it does decrease their lifespan and their quality of life, and it costs the hospital billions of dollars as well.
Any Sanford Bemidji regional employee was invited to submit their performance improvement ideas for the symposium, with each department expected to submit at least one project. Awards were granted for first, second, and third places. The winning project came from the emergency department, which looked at how reassessing patients' pain in a more timely manner can improve safety and satisfaction. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Coming up, we'll have more news from National Public Radio. We are hearing from Morning Edition about the publication of a signal chat with plans for striking Houthi rebels in Yemen. Stay tuned for those stories. And then local news, we'll hear about what's going on in the Minnesota legislature with our Report for Minnesota journalism students.
Our thanks goes out to Harmony Food Co-op, Bemidji's full-service downtown grocery store, offering people a variety of local, organic, and fair trade items. Open daily 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook.
Looking like upper 20s to low 30s right now.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Everyone can now read that group chat among senior national security officials who are discussing airstrikes in Yemen.
But that doesn't mean the story is over. Democrats say they still have questions about how the Trump administration is handling national security. Republicans, meanwhile, say it's time to focus on what they are calling a successful bombing campaign against the Houthis in Yemen.
For more, we're joined by NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee really grilled top national security officials yesterday. What should we take away from that?
Shortly before the hearing, The Atlantic magazine published details of the group chat on March 15th among the top security officials. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave the timing for the attacks 2 hours before they began, and he laid out a timeline for the warplanes and the drones and how they would take off and when. Now, Democrats said this was a major security failure, providing details of an imminent military strike on the publicly available messaging app Signal, and as we know, they included Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic. Here's Democrat Jason Crow of Colorado, who served as an Army Ranger in Iraq and Afghanistan.
It is completely outrageous to me that administration officials come before us today with impunity. Nobody is willing to come to us and say this was wrong. This was a breach of security and we won't do it again.
So how are Trump administration officials responding?
Well, CIA Director John Ratcliffe essentially said there's just nothing to see here.
I used an appropriate channel to communicate sensitive information. It was permissible to do so. I didn't transfer any classified information.
And Defense Secretary Hegseth, writing on X, was also adamant that there was no classified information released, and other officials have said the same. Now, President Trump has been saying the same thing. He was a bit more ambiguous when asked Wednesday evening if he still thought that no classified information was disclosed. He said, quote, "That's what I've heard. I don't know. I'm not sure. You have to ask the various people involved."
All right. So if there's no formal investigation, I mean, what's going to happen now?
Well, Democrats say they'll keep pressing for details in this particular case, like whether national security officials have been using Signal for other chats, because, you know, it's more convenient, though clearly not as secure as government communication networks. More broadly, the Democrats are questioning Trump's foreign policy. Trump has boasted about efforts to arrange ceasefires in Gaza and the Ukraine war, but the Gaza ceasefire between Israel and Hamas has collapsed. Russia and Ukraine are still attacking each other despite U.S. mediation efforts. So these haven't been quick successes that Trump had hoped for.
All right, so the bombing campaign in Yemen that the Trump administration say was successful. Enough evidence so far to say that?
Hey, not yet. Now, the U.S. forces have bombed the Houthis now for nearly 2 weeks, but we're getting relatively little information. Trump's team says the campaign will be much more robust than it was under the Biden administration, and that they'll halt the Houthi attacks on commercial shipping in the Red Sea, which the Houthis describe as solidarity with the Palestinians. But the Houthis have proved very tough, and it's just not clear whether a U.S. bombing campaign, even if it's sustained for a while, can end these attacks and return shipping to normal levels.
All right, that's NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thanks.
Sure thing, eh?
And we'll note here that NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of the nonprofit Signal Foundation.
Yesterday's hearing in the House followed one the day before in the Senate, where Democrat Mark Kelly sits on the Intelligence Committee. He heard from the same five officials who testified to the House, including Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe. Senator Kelly of Arizona joins us now for his reaction to both of this week's hearings. He also sits on the Senate Armed Services Committee and is a Navy combat veteran. Good morning, Senator. Thanks for coming back.
Good morning, Michelle. Thank you for having me on.
So I want to start by drawing on your perspective as someone who flew multiple combat missions. What do you make of the revelation that top intelligence officials were communicating about upcoming U.S. airstrikes in Yemen using that messaging app Signal?
Well, it's incredibly reckless. When I saw the details of what was shared over Signal by the Secretary of Defense, I was shocked. And there should be consequences for this kind of recklessness. When you are talking about time of launch off of an aircraft carrier, what type of airplanes, including beyond that, MQ-9s, Tomahawk missiles, time over target, these are the most sensitive pieces of information that any military has. An impending strike where you're having service members being put in harm's way.
So there was a moment during yesterday's hearing when Democratic Congressman Joaquin Castro questioned claims from the administration that the information in the messages was not classified. Let me just play that.
The idea that this information, if it was presented to our committee, would not be classified, y'all know is a lie. That's ridiculous. I've seen things much less sensitive be presented to us with high classification. And to say that it isn't is a lie to the country.
As you just said, I mean, the text published included aircraft being flown, when they launched, what specific weapons they were using, that, as you just recounted. So why does it matter whether this information was classified or not? If it wasn't classified, as they say, does that alleviate your concerns?
Well, it was certainly pulled from a classified document. I think they're just trying to deflect that there were no markings on this signal chain. But this information, whether it came specifically from a document that the Secretary of Defense was copying, or it was shared to him over a phone, maybe even a secure phone, he put on an unsecured system. And I flew combat missions, 39 of them, over Iraq and Kuwait in the first Gulf War. If the Iraqis had this kind of information, knowing that I'm going to be over the target at this time, it alerts them that you're coming, and they're going to be much more focused. They know where the aircraft carrier is generally. They know the direction you're coming from. This is the kind of thing that gets people killed. And there has to be accountability for this. It's the right thing to do for our service members. They're not going to trust the system if you have the Secretary of Defense and other officials out there being so careless and reckless about this type of information.
So what do you think should happen now?
Well, there needs to be an investigation. Roger Wicker, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee that I sit on, said this the other day. Some of my other colleagues, I know they're very disturbed by what happened here. And ultimately, my view is that the Secretary of Defense should resign. When he was confirmed or before his confirmation vote, you know, I asked my colleagues, is it worth the risk to have this person leading the Department of Defense? Our service members and our national security deserve more than Pete Hegseth. He's unqualified for this job. And if he doesn't resign, the president should fire him.
So Senator Wicker said he's looking for the Defense Department's Inspector General to investigate this. And I think you agree with that. But President Trump fired the DOD Inspector General. So is there somebody in that position?
He fired inspectors general across the country. So you got to get somebody in that position. You have to put a competent person in that position to investigate this mess of a national security blunder. I think it's almost, some of this stuff is almost comical, by the way, Michelle. At the end of this text message, the Secretary of Defense puts, "We are currently clean on OPSEC. That is operational security." That's what he said. On an unsecured message app where this information could have gotten into the hands of the Russians or the Iranians or the Houthis.
So just to be really clear about this, the president fired inspectors general across these agencies. Is there someone in place who could actually undertake an investigation like the one that Senator Wicker and you are calling for?
You could ask possibly the FBI to investigate it. Maybe you find a qualified inspector general from another agency, temporarily assign them to DOD for this. That's what the White House should be focused on right now.
And Senator Wicker is one of a handful of Republicans who have publicly voiced concerns. Do you think this is a bipartisan concern or not?
Oh, it absolutely is. My other Republican colleagues that are concerned about this privately need to come off the sidelines. And you need to speak truth to power when things like this happen that put service members at physical risk of getting killed, more American casualties. You got to stand up and say something to the White House.
So before we let you go, are there any other measures that you and the committee you sit on are working on? You know, recognizing the Democrats are in the minority in both the House and the Senate, and so their opportunity to, you know, demand other measures are limited. But are there any other measures or steps that you can take to express your concerns?
Well, we can continue to focus on this and explain it to the American people. This should be important to them. Young men and women, we all know folks in the military, family members, friends, their children that are going overseas, they're in harm's way. We've got to take steps to protect them. We've got to be careful. So I think the American people care about this. I know Americans care about folks that serve in the military. So we have to continue to talk about this until we get to the bottom of it. And then we've got to expect our highest officials here to use secure systems. They have to stop doing this kind of communication on unsecured apps like Signal.
That is Senator Mark Kelly. He's a Democrat, and he's from Arizona. Senator, and as we mentioned, a combat veteran. Senator Kelly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
I want to mention that we extended invitations to representatives of the White House and every member of the Trump administration who was in that Signal chat group, along with Republican lawmakers. All either declined or did not respond to our requests for interviews. This is NPR News.
It is 7:19. You're tuned in to the Thursday morning show with a mix of national news from Morning Edition and local news coming up next. I'm Heidi Holton.
I'm Sarah Bignall. Good morning.
Good morning. Stay tuned. We've got, here's what we're looking at for our weather today. Sunny with highs 47 to 55, increasing clouds in the evening, lows 29 to 36, east winds 5 to 10, gusting up to 20, and it looks like rain or freezing rain likely for tomorrow. We emptied some sap bags last night. We actually didn't have enough room to put them in the big container we have on the back of the four-wheeler.
Okay.
We didn't have enough. We're doing some reverse osmosis to it, so it's not as cloudy once we start the boil.
Okay.
And that takes a long time.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, it's fun. These are great temperatures for sap. I'm sure lots of folks are tapping out there, and we'd love to hear from you. 218-326-1234.
And did we hear from somebody with my book dilemma here, Heidi?
I think so. What she said, and I won't give it away here.
I have been obsessed with this series called Dungeon Crawler Carl. Mm-hmm. I have listened to this because it needs to be enjoyed via audiobook, mm-hmm. because the narrator is probably one of the greatest voice actors I have just ever, like, he has such distinct, such funny, it totally makes the book.
So she was talking about that, 'cause she didn't give the name. And she said, yeah, I'm so glad to hear someone likes it. I was feeling like it may have been an impulsive decision, but Reddit loves it.
Yes, Reddit does love it. So I have found an online community of folks to where you can, you know, just people have questions and,
right.
you know, you can theorize on what book 8's going to be like. But if this book has somehow made its way into your life, go and read The Dungeon Crawler Carl, and then we need to become friends so we can chat about it.
You can also tell us what you're reading. Text us at 218-326-1234. Earlier this morning, we were talking with Jeff Sundin, and he talked about how it's an odd time. Like, even at the Rainy River, you can fish on open water at the river and still fish on ice on Rainy Lake. That this weekend, you could fish for crappies or walleye on both open water and on ice throughout the state of Minnesota.
Okay.
Like, we're in such an interesting in-between time here. So
that's okay. It's a transitional time of year.
But don't forget this. The Minnesota DNR is reminding us to use extreme caution on area lakes. With these fluctuating temperatures and rain, ice can deteriorate quickly.
Yep. I generally just avoid the ice. That's be careful out there.
Right. Also want to let you know, today at 4:30, Brainerd Public Schools Legendary Women Hall of Fame is inducting a new class. It's at the Gitchie Zibi Center for the Arts. Social gathering at 4:30, and the ceremony begins at 5. And I believe that streams online. If you just search for the Brainerd Public Schools, you'll find it there.
So you don't need to go there to present the
I was asked to show up, but it's a little early in a work day from driving there at 4:30. So yeah, it was a fun... It's a very fun event, and it's just surprising. Last year, I got to be in the Legendary Women Hall of Fame and to meet people. And now, like, one of the people who was also in the class, now she works out of Duluth, and we've crossed paths and have done some things, had some conversations, and that's kind of interesting, too.
So I streamed the... ceremony last year. And
this is what Jennifer said on Monday when she talked about, I don't think I remember that you guys did it. I was pretty nervous.
Yeah. But it was very much like, this is your life, Heidi Holden.
I know I didn't. That's what made me very uncomfortable. Yeah.
But what amazing accomplishments though you've done since you left Brainerd High School, you know?
Well, the one thing I was telling myself, because people often think that I'm pretty good at public speaking because I'm on the radio, but I'm getting better. So as I was getting ready for this, I was like, well, at least I don't have to give a speech. I just have to go up there. And then I get an email right after that. We have unanimously chosen you to give the speech. And I'm like, I can't say no, right? Yeah. I could have, I suppose. But
we could have put some headphones on you and just slept, you know.
Yeah. I got a little weepy. My brother was there, you know, and we were, I mentioned my brother and my sister-in-law, which is wonderful. My Aunt Dottie came and my cousins, like people came from different parts of my life. And you know, just talked about how great that would have been if my folks were still around.
Yeah.
They would have loved that. Yeah. So that was really neat. Yeah. I liked it.
We're looking forward to the new slate. What is it? The new inductees? Into the...
It's a cool thing that Brainerd Public Schools does, and be cool if other schools around the region do that kind of thing. Is there a Hall of Fame for like Grand Rapids?
I'm guessing that there's a athletic kind of
That's the thing that's kind of interesting is it's not about just athletics.
Yeah.
And they have a regular Hall of Fame aside from the athletic one.
Okay.
So, I don't know.
Yeah.
Celebrations.
It's good, you know. Well, is it time here, Heidi, for our legis? It's time to hear about what's happening at the Minnesota Legislature. Each week, as part of Report for Minnesota through the Minnesota Journalism Center, News Director Chelsea Perkins checks in with our student reporters.
The Report for Minnesota student journalists from the U of M have returned to the state capitol after their spring break, and we're right back in the action. I'm Chelsea Perkins for KAXE, and joining me are Elias Thomas, Sam Cito, and Yvette Higgins. The trio are based at the Capitol in St. Paul, where they're busy working as reporters while also earning their journalism degrees. The Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication program is helping KAXE and other rural Minnesota outlets cover this legislative session. First, we hear from Elias.
My story was on a House bill about repairing wells and doing water treatment in wells that have nitrate pollution. And so the goal is to target southeast Minnesota areas where nitrate pollution is pretty prevalent and where the nitrate levels are above the safe amount. This bill would put about $8 million over the next 2 years towards those repairs, water treatment systems, and they're targeting highly vulnerable populations. So that's like houses with young children or houses with pregnant mothers, as they are more susceptible to harm from nitrates. The idea is that they'll go towards the highly vulnerable houses first and then pretty much spread the money out as much as they can.
So let's talk about the contamination there. I mean, what is the impact of nitrates? What exactly does it do when it's in the water?
It can cause a lot of health effects. The most extreme, it could, technically high nitrates can cause cancer. But the way that it occurs is it'll seep into the drinking water sources, whether it be from fertilized soil, wastewater, landfills. Because of the geology in southeast Minnesota, their groundwater is a lot more susceptible to those leaks and to that contamination, which is why they're targeting that area more specifically.
So what did it sound like you were hearing from legislators? Was there broad support of this bill?
It was authored by Republican Representative Stephen Jacob, but it has bipartisan support. The day I talked to Representative Jacob, he said, like, literally that afternoon, somebody had come into another Democrat to sign on. So there's a lot of support. I think they see the benefit of, you know, having clean drinking water. It's really there's no sides to this. You know, there's no really political advantage to agreeing with it or not. So it's definitely got a ton of bipartisan support. And I think it'll move through pretty easily.
You know, that makes me think of just how often the legislature is portrayed as being this really partisan body. But with bills like this and other bills that you guys have talked about with me in the past, I mean, they're coming together from both parties to really make things happen, assuming that this does get passed, right?
You're seeing more now that special election occurred. And I think there's more pushback from people that, like, okay, we do need to actually get things done. And so bills like this are a great example of the stuff that is really purely for Minnesotans. So it's good to see things like this moving along.
All right. Thanks, Elias. Moving on to Sam. Let's talk about your story.
This bill authored by Senator Mary Kunesh would establish this task force to create a memorial for Native American veterans that would be put on the Capitol grounds. Pretty much bipartisan support. It's a very simple bill. It'd be a 13-person task force. And I thought it was actually really interesting in my research when writing the story, writing about the bill, I didn't realize that Native Americans actually serve in the military at a significantly higher rate than typically. I think they serve at a 19% rate compared to 14% nationally, which only sounds like a couple of percentage points. But that means a lot when you're talking about breaking down demographics, that the amount that they serve.
You talked about in your story a little bit things that had been deleted from some websites at the federal level, seemingly as part of efforts to remove language related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. What did you learn there?
Senator Kunesh was speaking about how support for this bill and other bills to commemorate and memorialize the contributions of Native Americans were particularly important in relation to that. So Trump had an executive order that removed military content related to diversity, equity, inclusion. And it seems, and we've seen this a lot on a nationwide scale with the removal of diversity, equity, and inclusion related content, that not just the content that the administration seems to be targeting is being removed. There are a lot of these quote unquote unintended consequences and information about the contributions of Native American veterans, especially the Navajo code talkers, seem to be caught up in this mass sweep of removal of that content.
So it sounds like there's some bipartisan support for this bill as well. Any idea of a timeline if the task force is put together? How long in the future would we perhaps see a memorial?
It looks like that is still part of what's being worked out through the bill as well as the budget. Like that isn't set in stone just yet, as it's just now moving through the committees.
So this task force, I would assume, would also be looking at things like design and stuff like that as well.
The task force would be, it sounds at least to me, like handling a lot of the logistics and figuring out which artists or combination of artists would be appointed to design and create the memorial, kind of making sure that the right people are working for it.
Okay, last but not least, let's find out what you covered, Yvette.
I'm covering a couple bills that would reform cannabis laws a little bit and mostly just like clarify them. So one would try to improve access to medical marijuana for people by having virtual visits so that if you're far from a dispensary, you can still get care. And then also making it so that landlords and schools can't refuse enrollment or housing to people just on the basis of using medical marijuana. And then the last thing that that bill would do is allow tribes to also be protected by the bill. So there would be reciprocity for tribal patients so that they could receive care through this bill as well. And then the second bill would just make it so that the Office of Cannabis Management would become an official agency. So that would kind of open up conversation between tribes and the state government so that they could discuss regulations and kind of come to agreements on that.
What did you hear in the committee meetings that you were covering, or what did you learn about this as you were going along?
The bills by Senator Scott Dibble, and he said that these bills are just important to him, kind of said that they're pretty basic changes. They're not like changing the law, but he said that it's just important for there to be an open communication with the tribes, and it would just make it so that regulations are really clear for people.
Was there any testimony or anything like that that you could tell us a little bit about?
Yeah, there wasn't a ton from the public, but Eric Tauble, the director of the Office of Cannabis Management, came in and he kind of just explained why these changes are important for patients.
It sounds like this might be something that could have particular impact on rural people. You know, we're in a rural area, and if they're unable to get to a dispensary nearby, having this virtual visit situation might make it easier. I mean, was there a discussion about that?
He did mention that it would kind of affect rural communities because they're the ones that are sort of further from the dispensaries.
Stepping back a little bit, I mean, now that cannabis is legal for recreational purposes in Minnesota, some people might think, well, why does there even need to be a separate medical cannabis program? So what did you learn about the distinctions there, or how people might understand a little bit better about the separate medical need for cannabis?
Medical marijuana is actually cheaper for patients. So that's an important distinction because it's not subject to certain taxes that recreational marijuana is subject to. And then also you can get medical marijuana starting at 18 versus 21 for recreational use. And then also medical marijuana can be a little bit more potent, and you can get like specific advice from your doctor about what kind you should use and things like that.
What do we think is the likelihood of these bills going forward?
I asked Senator Dibble about that, and he said that like you can't be confident about anything during this time. So he didn't say he was confident about his bill, but from the sense of the meeting, there wasn't any questions or concerns that came up from other senators. So it seemed like at least in that committee, they seemed to be in support of these bills.
That was Report from Minnesota student journalists Elias Thomas, Sam Cito, and Yvette Higgins. Find their stories at our website, kaxe.org. If you have questions about state government or what your representatives are up to in St. Paul, shoot us an email at news@kaxe.org. And be sure to check out our coverage of the upcoming special election in Senate District 6 after the resignation of Senator Justin Eichhorn of Grand Rapids. For KAXE, I'm Chelsea Perkins.
You can find more news at KAXE.org, and we've got Larissa Donovan joining us in about 10 minutes. She'll be talking about the latest stories they're working on, and we'll have the Up North Report coming up in about an hour. I'm Heidi Holton with Sarah Bignall. It is Thursday morning. Up next, we have Best Wishes.
We receive support from Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, and saunas. More online at hotspringshottubmn.com. And we also receive support from the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. Well, it is time, is it not, for
it
Best
is.
Wishes, where we get to wish our friends and neighbors a happy birthday and happy anniversary. And for today, March 27th, happy 73rd birthday to Michael Goldberg.
Hey, Michael. He's our host of Stay Human. Stay Human coming up on Saturday at 9 o'clock. Make sure you tune in today. On Saturday, it is all about stories of animals and mysteries.
Oh.
Bumblebees and moose and wild cat.
There you go. Tune in for that. Christina Monson, she is celebrating her 46th birthday today from Grand Rapids. Mike Hayes is turning 75 today from Bemidji. And Mary Bovee from Duluth is celebrating a birthday as well.
Yesterday we had her husband, I believe, because you remember Bovee.
Yeah.
Yeah. So cool. That's a cool thing. We can listen to our album of the week. Sarah, how do you feel about Charlie Crockett?
Oh, I like this album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
New album from him, a musician from Texas, his 15th in 9 years, and it's produced by Waylon Jennings' son, Shooter Jennings.
I am a night rider. I got this guitar on my knee. Learned to hold it up high down New Orleans. I'm a night rider. I ride like the wind. Oh, I'm a night rider on a road that has no wind. Maybe you've seen me just riding through your town. Black on black Wrangler with my steps and boots down. Oh, I'm a night rider. I'm a night rider. I'm quiet as the dawn. Like a blue bonnet in springtime. You look away and I'll be gone. Oh, I'm a night rider. Yes, I ride like the wind. Ho, ho! I'm a night rider on a road that has no wind. Thank you.
From our album of the week, that's Charlie Crockett, and you are tuned in to the Thursday Morning Show. We love hearing from you. What do you think of our album of the week? You can text 218-326-1234. The Lonesome Drifter is the name of his new album.
And coming up, we'll be talking with Larissa Donovan, letting us know what's happening at the news desk here at KAXC. And we also have a daily dose of phenology coming up pretty soon. But before we get to that, our thanks goes out to Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. More at paulbunyan.net. And we also receive support from Clocko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, who are continuing their Sunday Fun Day events each weekend. And the last Sunday of the month is open mic with Diddy Wish, where the stage opens up to the community's art, whether it's music, comedy, or anything else. Info at clockobrewing.com.
Time for our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer.
On today's date, March 27th, 1991, the first of what I expect will be a massive influx of migrating juncos has shown up in my yard. These first ones are typically males. The males tend to be dark gray with a white belly, a sort of a two-colored bird. They look as though they were dipped in a pan of wet white paint, and their bottom half is white and their top half is gray-black. The really easily identified feature of the junco is when it flies, you will see white tail feathers on the outsides of the tail. So boundaries of the tail are white feathers on both sides, and that makes the junco pretty easy to identify. There are some that spend their summers here in northern Minnesota, and even a few intrepid ones that will spend their winters here. But basically, they are migrating through the area spring and fall, and this marks the beginning of the spring migration to the north.
That is our daily dose of phenology. This is the exciting time of year where, with all of the changes, if you missed Tuesday morning, so many reports coming in from students. We're going to listen to one of them now. Are you ready?
I am ready. Where in the state? Because
this is East Rapids. So this is a school that John goes to once a week, or a couple times a month at least, and visits them. So here's East Rapids.
My name is Lauren. This is our phenology report from Mr. Cody's third grade classroom at East Rapids Elementary. It was a cloudy and brisk day. We went for a little different walk. We found running sap in both maple and pine trees. It tasted good. There was also deer scat and a fuzzy unidentified leaf. We also found fuzzy buds on the trembling aspen and mountain ash. On the ground was a yellow shafted flicker feather. Some green growth were also sneaking through the brown grass. Lastly, we saw and heard songbirds, but couldn't get an ID. All for now, Lauren.
Thanks, Lauren, for that.
I like the little sign-off there. All for now.
Yeah. East Rapids just recently won an award from around the state of an excellence award, and they called John in to thank him that he was part of it. And
oh, nice.
Sounds like it was a wonderful little ceremony.
Yeah, it's been fun hearing from the classrooms that are further south,
mm-hmm.
just because like they have a little bit more of signs of spring than what we do here.
Mosquitoes and dandelions, say the kids in Northfield.
Yep. So on the way, I'm not excited about the mosquitoes, but, you know, dandelions, that's kind of a sign of spring there.
And yeah.
They'll be here before we know it, even though we might have some rain and snow in our forecasts there.
Right.
It will be on the horizon.
You never know, right? We're expecting sunny skies today with highs 47 to 55, increasing clouds in the evening, lows 29 to 36. And east winds 5 to 10, gusting up to 20. Keep in mind, we are near, especially in northeastern Minnesota, near critical fire weather conditions. This is the time of year especially to be watching out how you are outside and paying attention to campfires and all of that kind of stuff, because things can burn really quickly. quickly.
Yeah. And last year you talked to Marshall, who was talking about the fire danger last year, and you don't really think about what snowpack can do to like kind of underbrush, that you need that to kind of compact down. And when we don't have the snow like we haven't been having in past winters, on how dry it makes, even though this might seem typical spring-like, mm-hmm. you know, the conditions haven't been there to kind of tap down fire danger, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, so be careful.
Yes, be careful out there.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. You are always welcome to text us. It's 218-326-1234. Coming up in an hour, I'm very excited about this. Next week, the Edge Center for the Arts is putting on the play Anne of Green Gables.
Aww.
One of my favorite books, movies. I did not know there was, I mean, I'm not surprised, but that there is a stage version of this. So director Stephanie Kessler is going to be in to talk to us about it. And yeah, I love. Did you read Anne of Green Gables?
No, but I feel it was on PBS.
Yes, that was the one with, I watched, I had the VHS, I still do somewhere, of that. And they always rolled it out at fundraiser time.
Yep.
Yes. But the actress who played Anne, Megan Follows from Canada, was just, and it was so beautifully shot.
Yeah.
Of Nova Scotia, and absolutely loved it. I got to see Megan Follows in the 90s in a play at the Guthrie. She played Nora in A Doll's House.
Okay.
It was amazing to see her on stage.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can't wait.
All right, good. Well, that's coming up later today.
Yep. Coming up, we're going to be talking with Larissa Donovan. Stay tuned. That is The Dip, and this is the Thursday morning show. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. People power the stories that we cover. They let us know what's going on in their region, and then the folks who run the newsroom, people like Chelsea and Larissa and Megan, they go out and get the stories for us. Larissa Donovan joining us this morning. Hey, Larissa.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You are welcome. All right. We got a lot to talk about. When I saw you yesterday, though I want to, I don't know if you were able to do this. You were headed out to Lake George. I wonder if we can start there.
Well, I haven't gone there yet.
Okay.
I want to get there nice and early so I can maybe treat some guys to coffee so they can maybe chat up a little bit about what's going on. Because from what I understand, a really tiny but very like long operating, like 122 years, this little log cabin post office in Lake George is officially closed. They began operating in 1903. It was moved to a remotely operated post office under the direction of the Park Rapids Postmaster General back in 2013. But apparently the lease for the little post office was terminated, and operations for Lake George customers, a lot of that in-person stuff like PO boxes, package delivery, that's all being rerouted to La Porte as of today, which is some 13 miles, I believe, east.
So what does that mean to a small town like Lake George?
Well, rural mail delivery will continue in Lake George. That won't be impacted, but just kind of that in-person interactions that a lot of folks are, you know, kind of accustomed to in small town Minnesota. Some of that's going to go away. And I'm hoping to learn more when I visit Lake George, hopefully bright and early tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah. And you have also been checking out the special elections that we have coming up as well.
So much information.
I have been a bit on the peripheral of that, you know, being a little on the Western front. But I have been staying abreast of this story because I cannot help it. cannot help it. But yeah, there's a wide swath of candidates. Filing just opened yesterday, and it looks like five Republicans who announced their intentions to run have already filed. I believe there's a few more. And there might be even more filed that haven't announced. So it kind of remains to be seen. I know that special election is coming up very quickly.
Yeah, we're talking about the seat Justin Eichhorn just stepped down from, Senate District 6 seat. And do you know how long? There's not a really long period where they can, because the governor announced when the special election will be, right? There'll be a primary.
Right, there's going to be a special primary already, and then a special election a few days after that. So this is going to be a pretty quick turnaround. But I lost all my info with the numbers.
Okay. Well, and
the
it's,
numbers and the names on the
there iTask, we go.
But Chelsea and Megan have been doing a really great job staying on top of that.
And I noticed that MinnPost also has picked up the reporting from KEXC on this, on who has filed. So there you go.
So we've also been following things with tribal colleges and federal funding, and that's something you've been working on for a little while here, and kind of what that has meant to those communities.
Right, and you know, it's something that, you know, these things about you know, quality of life, providing healthcare, education, a lot of these trust responsibilities were promised in treaties from between tribal nations and the American government. Centuries, in many cases, centuries ago. And a lot of, unfortunately, what happens is that the amount of money that Congress allocates per tribally enrolled student is often at the whim of executive orders and political feelings at the time, despite this longstanding trust, responsibility, relationship between American Indian tribes and the American government.
Yeah. So who did you talk to about this?
Well, I spoke with president of the Red Lake Nation College and one of Red Lake's hereditary chiefs, Dan King. I took a visit up there not too long ago and, you know, visited the campus, had a nice chat with him, you know, appreciated some of that nice, fierce wind coming off of Lower Red Lake. We got a really great selfie on the balcony of that, by the way. And I also talked with the president of Leech Lake Tribal College, Helen Montgomery, and it was kind of striking the same kind of challenges they're dealing with. Some of the funding has already been frozen, and they're quickly having to pivot. A pretty large grant from USDA that focused on expanding tribal college programs, not only for students, but also community ed for forestry and sustainable agriculture, these sort of things. This fund was apparently frozen, and these scholarships were already granted to these students. The students have already been aware that, oh, we received these scholarships, but now the funding for them has vanished, so the college is pivoting to be able to continue to provide these scholarships. But higher education is, you know, a challenging thing, especially in, you know, the tribal college setting, where unlike a lot of other public institutions that receive generous state subsidies, these rely on a lot of different federal funding streams, not only from the Bureau of Indian Education, but also the U.S. Department of Education, which, as we have seen in the national news, is under particular fire at the moment.
That'll be interesting to read and to hear. Your update on that?
A lot of moving parts to it. I'm trying to get it all together in a way that...
Yeah. Well, speaking of Red Lake, last week you were at the memorial event. What was that like?
It was, you know, I brought my 5.5-year-old daughter with me for that too. You know, it's a community sort of a gathering, and everyone was invited to attend. So I thought it was, you know, it was really impactful. Like, just... you know, how close of a community Red Lake is. Like everyone on Red Lake knew someone who was impacted by that tragedy. Mm-hmm. And I was speaking with superintendent of Red Lake Schools, Tim Lutz. He's been a superintendent around here in northern Minnesota for a while now. He's been at Red Lake for a few years now, but he remarked that it's something like half the community wants to remember, but half of it wants to forget, which mm-hmm. I can also understand. But there is a push to put a permanent memorial for the victims of this tragedy on the shores of Lower Red Lake between the beautiful campuses of the Red Lake Nation College and the Red Lake Government Center. These are pretty new buildings that resemble eagles, so they're pretty striking structures. Mm-hmm. But right between these two, there's already a veterans memorial really close to the government center, but further towards the tribal college, there's a plan to get a permanent memorial on for this tragedy on that site. They're about a quarter of the way to their goal. I talked to some of the organizers of the 32105 project. That project joined the Northwest Minnesota Foundation Family of Funds in late 2024, and they continue to accept donations, and they will until they reach their goal. They recently got a grant somewhere around $100,000 towards realizing this, but even with the grant, only a quarter of the way there.
Hmm. Okay. And finally, you have an update on a Sanford Health event that's coming up.
Well, this event happened last week, but it was the Sanford Health Symposium, which featured 39 projects across the Sanford Health of Northern Minnesota campus, where they kind of featured the work of frontline workers who, you know, tried to identify problems and do research to find solutions, just to like increase patient satisfaction and safety was a big priority, as well as improve hospital operations. You know, in the wake of Medicaid being a primary insurer around here, not really keeping up with costs of reimbursement, you know, making hospital operations more efficient is a primary goal, I think, across many Sanford health departments.
So you never run out of topics to be covering.
Never.
Huh? what's your day look like today? What kind of thing? Just to, you know, pull the curtain aside of what a reporter is working on in a day.
Well, you know, staying on top of, you know, a lot of it is a lot of online research. Some of it from things that happened just recently, and some things that happened a long time ago that maybe don't have a lot of understanding, particularly when it comes to tribal law from like the 1970s and stuff, when like a lot of the tribal self-determination stuff was passed. A lot of that's coming up right now.
Wow.
Good thought.
Yeah, there you go. That is Larissa Donovan, one of our reporters. She reports from Northwestern Minnesota. And if you have a story going on in your region, we always want to hear from you. You can email news@kaxc.org. Keep up the good work, Larissa.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Coming up, we'll have news headlines from National Public Radio at 9 o'clock this morning. We're on Headwaters, and it is Malachi Coons, who is our host.
All right. Want to tune in for that. ICTV and KEXE are hosting a forum for Itasca County Board District 4 candidates Larry Hopkins and Pat Maduri ahead of the April 8th special election. You can go to watchictv.org or on our website at kexe.org under Itasca Election Guide to learn more about the candidates.
Coming up this Saturday, the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids hosts Maple Music and Phenology from 10 to 3. They'll feature traditional maple syruping, an all-day musical jam session, and nature hikes.
And we've been working on a new series, and literally we have been working on a new series, Unplugged. If you have any questions about KAXE, maybe it's funding, programming decisions, music decisions that we make around here, we are wanting to be more transparent. You know, there's a lot of misinformation being passed around on kind of what public media is. And we realize that people don't have the information to fully understand what it does to make this whole thing work. So,
yeah, no, ask any question that you have about how things are operated, how operations go around here. We've got two articles. Sarah did the first one. Mine just came out this week about programming. We have plans for lots more about how music happens, how our business and membership and all of that kind of stuff happens. Especially still, I talk it up quite a bit, the visual.